Hey, it's Liz Kelly, and welcome to the Ringer Podcast Network. As the year comes to a close, our staff is writing about our favorite sports moments of 2019. Jason Concepcion explains the year in 10 pieces of pop culture, and we break down the last 10 years of the Marvel Universe. Also, ahead of the new Star Wars movie coming out next week, the staff's discussing Baby Yoda, Rise of Skywalker romances, and what the Resistance will do if they win. You can check this all out on theringer.com.
I'm Sean Fennessy.
I'm Amanda Dobbins.
And this is The Big Picture, a conversation show about the vulgar auteur himself, Michael Bay. That's right. Michael Bay has made a new movie. It's called Six Underground.
It's the sixth, bitch!
Okay. Six Underground is on Netflix right now. Joining us to discuss this movie is Chris Ryan. He's going to be sharing some feelings emanating from his exploding heart. Later in the show, I'll have an interview with Paul Walter Hauser, the star of Richard Jewell. You may remember Paul from I, Tonya and BlacKkKlansman. He's really great in Clint Eastwood's new movie, and he's really one of the most entertaining people we've ever had on this show, so I hope you'll stick around for that conversation. We'll talk about that movie next week, Amanda and I, and maybe Bombshell as well. But speaking of bombshells, Six Underground, let's go. Let's do this. Who is Michael Bay? Chris, how do you answer that question?
He's a circus leader. He's a carnival barker, and he's a cinematic genius.
Amanda?
I would say he's Sean's favorite filmmaker. This is nice. Sean is just going to have a nice, happy time. And Chris and I are here to support you.
Thank you.
He is a visionary. That is for sure. Of what is something we're going to discuss on this podcast. But he has a very specific film language. And, you know, he does a lot with it.
He certainly does. Michael Bay is a 54-year-old man. Born and raised in Los Angeles, California. He's made a great many films that a great many people have seen. I suspect a lot of the listeners of this show are familiar with his work. But he's fallen a bit on deaf ears.
He's been on the dark side of the moon, bro.
Yeah. He's gotten caught up in some stuff in the last 10 years that I'm not thrilled about. But let's just run very quickly through his CV. He, after a very successful career as a commercial and music video director, made his debut with Bad Boys in 1995, which kicks ass. He then made a film called The Rock, another film that
Classic.
Kicks ass.
Yeah.
He followed it up with Armageddon, one of the totemic films of the late 90s, and a big movie for many people who work here at The Ringer.
Incredible stuff.
He then made a movie called Pearl Harbor, which we don't talk about on this podcast. And then he made Bad Boys 2. That's an incredible run.
Mm-hmm.
If he died the moment that production wrapped after Bad Boys 2, we'd be like, this guy.
And I'm kind of surprised he didn't.
He has obviously an insane, operatic, ridiculous, oftentimes quite bad and incoherent filmmaking style that I still find immensely thrilling, that is aesthetically joyful to me. And I'm not saying he's smart. I'm not saying he is a brain genius of story.
A brain genius.
I'm not saying he's one of those things.
No.
But he is able to do things in his movies that send chills down my spine. And his later films after this period are a little bit complicated because he got caught up in Transformers world.
Yeah.
And he made four Transformers movies. Five Transformers movies? Five.
He directed all of them, didn't he?
Yeah. And
God, that's so many Transformers.
Some of them are actually pretty good.
I gotta admit, I haven't revisited them.
Well, I profiled Bay in I think it was 2010 for GQ. And
so 2011. I have the link.
2011.
Open.
Thank you for correcting me there. And he was making Transformers Dark of the Moon, which is the third film. And the second film is really not good. It's called Revenge of the Fallen. And he was like, and that movie was made sort of during the writer's strike.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little.
That was the problem.
Well, even by Michael Bay standards, it was very, very hard to understand. Three is pretty good. It was a bit of a comeback. Four and five.
Isn't three about like the JFK assassination? Like Optimus Prime does it?
It is. Optimus Prime is not responsible for the death of JFK, but there is a lot of space race information in the film.
Gotcha.
It's just like The Irishman.
They have a relationship. Yeah. They're both about labor. And anyway, he gets trapped in this Transformers story. He emerges to make a movie called 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi.
You and I saw together in a movie theater right after Christmas in Glendale.
I wouldn't say it was one of the best viewing experiences of my life. I love to spend time with you, Chris. I love to see movies with you, especially movies that we view as dumb shit entertainments that we want to apply serious meaning to.
Yeah.
I would say that one let me down. He followed it up with another Transformers movie. It felt like Michael Bay was in the wilderness. Lo and behold, Netflix comes along and they tell us, we'd like to give Michael Bay all the money to do whatever he wants to do. And he did it. He did it. He brought us Six Underground.
Why are you playing this so like calm and close to the, like, just go ahead.
We're not talking about Six Underground yet. I'm just setting the stage.
Okay. But Michael Bay being back is something that you were just like literally screaming at the top of your lungs.
Bay is back.
On Hollywood Boulevard last night.
Yeah, we saw the film together. We're going to get to the film in a minute. I just want to say, I'm just delighted. I was delighted by his return. I'm delighted that it's Netflix who's bringing him back. And there's a very big reason for that, which we'll get into. And it felt like for years, and who could have known if you ever watch a movie like The Rock, that this man had shackles on him, but he had shackles on him.
Six Underground makes The Rock look like Marriage Story. All of the action in The Rock could be squeezed into the first 17 minutes of Six Underground.
Absolutely. So before we go any further and get into the depths of Six Underground, I'm going to outline some film theory for you guys. Oh, are you ready?
This is great. Yeah,
this
go ahead.
Amazing shit.
Yeah, just can I do the backstory on this?
Sure.
Which is that Sean and I prepared this podcast outline together, and Sean did part of it, and I kind of filled the rest in, and I came back about 20 minutes before this recording just to refresh on what was in the podcast, and Sean had added this entire paragraph called vulgar auteurism. So go ahead, Sean.
I'm so excited to define vulgar auteurism for listeners of The Big Picture. Here is what it is. Coined by the critic Andrew Tracy and lovingly adopted by critics like Ignaty Vishnevetsky, who defines vulgar auteurism as enthusiasm for directors who work in genre filmmaking, mainly action, but also figures like the Farrelly brothers. It applies essentially the exact same auteur theory developed by the French critics in Cahiers du Cinéma in the 50s, which extended authorship to genre filmmakers like Hitchcock or Howard Hawks, but broadens what we might deem big or small budget trash. Michael Bay, to me, is the absolute lord of the vulgar auteurs.
That's
he is the megalodon. He is the king. Now, there are other people who have been involved in this conversation. I think, Chris, a lot of your favorite filmmakers could be incorporated into this.
Yeah.
Tony Scott.
For sure.
Michael Mann, to some degree, even though he is a very sort of respectable
type. Yeah.
Neville Dean Taylor was a big one when this was first developed, and their career has kind of gone sideways. Somebody like John M. Chu, who was making movies like G.I. Joe movies at the time and now has a completely different career because of
John Woo would be a good example of this.
Certainly.
Yeah. De Palma in some ways is.
Absolutely. There is also a kind of straight-to-VOD kind of action filmmaker, guys like John Hyams, who made like a lot of Universal Soldier movies in the late 2000s, early aughts. This term has kind of vanished. It was it was very big on film internet. Even before film Twitter, film internet was very into vulgar auteurism. Bay is perfect for it for me because he has a very clear idea of what he's interested in. And he is the author of his movies, even if he doesn't write any of the scripts. And I don't think he's ever written a script in his life.
I don't even know if he knows how to write.
I don't either. Or read, for that matter. But what he knows how to do is explore the human heart.
Yeah.
And he does that by making things go very fast, making them go very loud.
And then they fucking explode.
And then blowing shit up.
Yeah.
That is what he does.
Yeah.
And it sounds dumb and it is dumb. And sometimes it's okay to be dumb. Amanda, you have things that you like that you know are dumb.
Yeah, of course. I think dumb is unfair.
Okay.
Because I think he's sort of a savant. It's ridiculous in like the actual, I cannot believe that I'm watching this. And I go to the movies to see things that I cannot see anywhere else and that maybe don't even exist. And that is what he excels at. And then you just blow all of that shit up. But it is operatic, giant scale. So I think it requires skill. It's not dumb.
It definitely requires skill. It's a kind of management in a high stakes way that I think we kind of overlook. Because Bay's reputation is as this dictatorial, you know, guy rolling around on a giant crane, barking orders at people, screaming,
telling
into
Shia LaBeouf to get closer to the explosion.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when I was reporting that story about him almost 10 years ago, a lot of people were like, this is a tough motherfucker. He can be really mean on set. He's got a really clear vision of what he wants, and he is not going to pat you on the back at the end of the day. He has a militaristic approach, and you can understand that when you look at his movies, which are very adoring of the U.S. military and military power.
Mm-hmm.
He's a bit of a fascist in that way. And so it's hard to celebrate somebody like this.
Not just in that way, yes.
We'll explore the themes of Six Underground as well. So it's I don't want to confuse the emotional, ideological bent of Michael Bay with what he's able to do as a filmmaker. And that is the thing that I'm interested in talking about most especially. Though I guess we can also talk about some of the flaws of the thinking behind his movies. What else to say about the vulgar auteurs and what Michael Bay does before we dive into this movie?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we often ascribe a certain genius to somebody like Spielberg because he has an understanding of how camera movement and cutting and lighting get at like a deep part of your brain that just reacts to those things, like on a very sensory, visceral level. And he understands that and then turns it past 11. On the dial to be like, what if I could make your heart explode? What if I could break your eardrums? What if I make your eyeballs pop out of your head? There is not a single shot in Michael Bay's entire filmography that isn't essentially sexualizing and aestheticizing like any single thing he points his camera at. He's incapable of not viewing it as an object of desire and consumption and power and eroticism, whether it's a fucking robot or it's a Ferrari, or a woman, or a man, you know, like, because that happens in 13 hours, too. It's just beefcakes for 2 hours, and then Benghazi pops off.
Yes, it's John Krasinski dripping wet with an additional 40 pounds of muscle on top of Jim Halpert. And all of it is sexualized. You're right. A bottle of Coke, sexualized. Yeah. A missile, sexualized. He is the phallic god come to explain human desire and impulse in these really stupid action movies. And that feels like applying something deeper than it actually is onto the movie. But I think if you psychoanalyzed Michael Bay, he would get to that place. He would understand that that is what drives him in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but it's all just kind of impulse driven. And I don't know that he would sit there and be like, I, you know, shot this missile or this Coke bottle in this way because it has this shape. And also I'm trying to express this, but he does his films are about that just a deep inherent desire and like unexamined like expression of ourselves.
Yeah.
And mostly men, but there's something they're like quote traditionally masculine movies, but there's something that's so obvious about them and so like unfiltered that doesn't make them as offensive to me. I guess maybe I'm just
so
used
cheesy.
To it. Yeah, they're cheesy and it just kind of like is what it is. I don't think you're really like wading below the surfaces trying to understand what this means for a generation of like women. Who gives a shit? It's just, it's on its face in a way. And I think that that's true both of, for every part of his filmmaking. It just like is what it is at a maximalist level.
Yeah, there's no, he wouldn't even know how to virtue signal. Like he is completely disconnected. He's been an extremely wealthy and successful person for many years. He's kind of checked out on the idea of even like symbolism, mm-hmm. you know, like he is just doing what he thinks is cool. And in its way, that is the symbol. Mm-hmm. That is the symbol for a kind of certain masculine impulse. I think that his movies worked best when they were very easy to explain.
Yeah.
There's a giant meteor and the only people that can stop it from destroying Earth are a bunch of oil rig workers in Texas. A disgruntled general has taken over Alcatraz and is threatening San Francisco with nuclear warheads.
Yeah.
Very clear explanation. Two badass cops in Miami are going to wreck shit. Those are his best movies. The Transformers movies don't work that well because there's this arcane mythology about something that doesn't matter. And also there's way too much CGI. And he, in many respects, is like a practical filmmaker. And I think the stuff that works best even in Six Underground is the stuff that it's like, even if it isn't real, even if it is animated, it feels real mm-hmm. or close to real. Mm-hmm. The stuff that is science fiction, I just don't get.
Yeah, you can tell that at the heart of Transformers in like whenever Steven Spielberg was like, yeah, I'll put my name on this, was like A Boy and His Robot. And they wanted to make this kind of like heartfelt E.T. Amblin Entertainment version, and he was like, fuck that. I am throwing 80 robots and crashing into a highway and having like a foot race with Decepticons through Miami. I mean, it's just like, that's so far removed from what like the kernel of the idea of that movie was. The fact that he made five of them is kind of a hilarious mistake at this point now when you look back on it.
Yeah, we missed out on a lot of interesting movies. And this movie, Six Underground, makes me long for what we could have gotten from 2009 through 2018 from him. You know, he did make Pain and Gain, which we didn't mention here.
Oh, yeah.
Which is kind of an interesting movie that I think is not totally successful. It's kind of his closest stab at a comedy, a kind of bodybuilder's action comedy,
yeah,
which I think was a victim of a few things. One, it's not great. Two, it was weirdly marketed. Three, the timing on it just was not ideal. It's a movie starring The Rock and Mark Wahlberg.
I think it also was bad because it tried to exist within reality. For the most part, even though it was shot in Miami and was about bodybuilders and had cocaine and fights and all this stuff, it essentially tried to live within the laws of physics. Michael Bay should not be adherent to the laws of physics, ever.
I agree. When he was finishing up Transformers Dark of the Moon and we spoke, I was like, what are you doing next? And he was like, I can't tell you, but what I can tell you is it's my 70s movie. Mm-hmm. It's like my character-driven little indie movie.
That is so funny that he thinks that.
And, you know, the movie costs like $50 million and it's about bodybuilders who rob banks. I think he's a really interesting guy and I'm very interested to see how Six Underground is received. What to you guys jumped out while watching it specifically that you were like, this either impressed me or it scared me or I felt compelled to talk about it?
I think even for Michael Bay, the so muchness of it, we all walked out and were like, was there a single note given on this entire movie? Was there a single budgetary limit? Is this literally, I think it's the closest that I've ever felt to just like seeing what Michael Bay's brain is like without any sort of like intermediary.
Unfiltered.
Yeah.
And that was quite literally awe-inspiring and frightening. It's remarkable also that he just gets to do this in 2019 because there is, I don't know, there's an explosion or something insane every 5 seconds. Like every 5 seconds.
I'm going to briefly describe the plot of this movie. Hopefully it adheres closely to the short descriptions I gave to his other movies. So after faking their own deaths, six individuals form a vigilante squad in order to take down notorious criminals. All of them were brought to the team by its leader, played by Ryan Reynolds, for their unique skills and a desire to erase their past and change the future. Mm-hmm. So it's what? One part Ocean's 11, one part The Dirty Dozen?
I do think it's worth mentioning, and we can get more into this. It's also incredibly autobiographical because it is about a billionaire who's tired of taking notes. It's about a billionaire who's like, there's just nothing but red tape in the government if you try to go through like philanthropy or anything. So what I decided to do was put together my own SEAL Team 6 and take out warlords and dictators that I designate as evil.
Yes, it is.
I don't think we can overhype this. Like, I watched this movie. I felt purified. I also felt filthy. I was baptized in the waters of cinema. This is one of the most exciting 2 hours I've spent in a movie theater in a really long time. And I came out feeling like I had a film of fucking slime all over me because it is completely morally bankrupt. Yes. In a way that is, yeah, almost hysterical. It is almost hilarious.
Absolutely. I think what I said to you guys afterwards is this is Mike Bloomberg's favorite movie of all time, yeah, because it really just valorizes the idea that someone could
like
do
Dan
this.
Dan Bilzerian's favorite movie, yes, of all time.
Yes. It's someone who has a more grotesque taste,
yeah,
in the world. And the Ryan Reynolds character is super interesting because he's played by Ryan Reynolds, who just does not strike you as the kind of guy who's like, what I need to do is make everyone think I killed myself in a Red Bull stunt plane.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out Red Bull.
Shout out Red Bull.
No free ads.
There's an extraordinary amount of SponCon in this movie as well, which we can talk about. And then recruit other people who are somehow highly skilled, but also capable of great illegality, and make them work for me, but I also will not have any meaningful relationship with them at all. Yeah. And in fact, I will encourage them to not share anything about themselves to anyone in the world. Which, how would you guys feel if someone came to you and asked you to do that?
Am I already dead? Like, I'm dead. I quote-unquote died?
Yeah, sure.
I'd be into it.
Yeah?
Well, you can't have quote-unquote died because he stages the deaths for you. So,
right.
Like, I mean, you have to have been, you must be, you're on the run. You know,
yeah, if I found myself in the position of some of the characters in this movie, I think I'd be down to get a second lease on the afterlife.
Can I ask you guys something? Because I did go to the bathroom at one point. Maybe I missed it, though. Probably not. Was compensation discussed at any point for
I think that it's like money is no object. Because like I'm sure at any given point, it's just like he's straight cryptoing and he's Bitcoining and he's like maybe skimming a little off the top.
If you're saying to me, come with me, quit your former life, stage a funeral, don't ever use your real name or identity again, and work for me to target you know, the most dangerous people on earth, and I'll pay you in Bitcoin? Well, the answer is no.
One of the things that they actually, I mean, this is like this in crazy libertarian movie. One of the things that they talk about is like one of the advantages of being a supposed dead spooks is that they don't have to pay taxes anymore. They're like, yeah, dude, it's sick. Yeah, my mom cried at my funeral, but I don't have to pay income tax anymore.
Yeah.
That's like a scene in this movie. It's like the quietest scene is people being like, man, it's awesome not having to pay taxes.
So the Ryan Reynolds character has gotten wealthy because he is a master of magnet technology. Literally, he has designed technology with magnets that has revolutionized our society,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, is that's metaphorical writing. He is a person who is drawing other people to him with his ingenuity, his wit, and his cash.
Yeah.
The problem is that you don't sense that there's any connectivity amongst these people at all. And we can run down the six of them if you'd like. I think Amanda has a helpful category here later in the show that identifies why any of these other people are in this movie.
Yeah.
Because it's very confounding. I guess I probably would do it. I would probably accept the job. I wouldn't accept the job, though, if the home base was an abandoned airplane hangar.
In the desert.
In the desert.
Yeah.
Which seems like not a chill place to hang out.
Also, I just want to say in terms of like, real, like, Knicks-esque drafting by Ryan Reynolds. Like, I when they were announcing, like, what each person does, which is a classic, like, you know, team-up, Dirty Dozen kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, it's the explosives expert. They have a guy who's really good at parkour.
Yeah.
A Colombian cartel hitman. Melanie Laurent, who just, honestly, is the fucking Terminator in this movie, yeah. And we'll probably spend an hour talking about her. Dave Franco is the driver. They have a doctor,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of like limited because how much could she possibly do before they have to take somebody to a hospital anyway?
A lot in the first 17 minutes of this movie, which we can discuss, but anyway.
And then they have Corey Hawkins.
Corey Hawkins.
Who is brought in from the Deltas. So he is an actual soldier. But otherwise, not exactly like blue chip first round draft picks.
It's just a confounding collection of people. You know, when you watch a movie like The Dirty Dozen, you're like, oh, I actually recognize all of those people as significant character actors of their time. Ryan Reynolds, Melanie Laurent, okay. I get it. I get what Bay is doing with Melanie Laurent. No one loves a striking blonde more than Michael Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Dave Franco, comic relief, that's a must for him. He always has to have the wisecracking guy, Buscemi in Armageddon. You know, this is he always has that. Adria Arjona is not an actress I'm familiar with, but she also fills the kind of like, she's kind of like when Denise Richards was the nuclear physicist in the Bond movie.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, incredibly beautiful, striking, supermodel-esque woman who is also a genius doctor, who also does not get a backstory in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Hardy, who is a man who I guess is famous.
That's the parkour guy?
Yeah, that's the parkour guy.
He was in Bohemian Rhapsody. That's
I learned this last night.
Okay. Yeah. Does he do parkour in Bohemian Rhapsody?
No, unfortunately. Maybe that would have made it a better movie.
When we were watching this movie, I think we all thought Ben Hardy was just a professional parkour dude.
I thought it was Billy Magnussen, with all respect to Billy Magnussen.
I'll tell you right now, if you want to know the two major influences on Six Underground, it's Black Hawk Down
mm-hmm.
and GoPro YouTube videos of like adventure tourism in Croatia of guys who are like, check out how I ran across this roof in Belgrade, bro. And it's like, and then the cops came, but we were already laughing. Deuces. That's like literally a quarter of the influence on this film.
Let's talk a little bit more about the style.
Yeah.
So the editing in the movie is a little bit different for Michael Bay movies. He is a fast cutting, intense action filmmaker. But the first 17 minutes of this movie, which is one long chase scene throughout
Florence,
Italy,
mm-hmm.
is as up close,
seizure inducing,
and as fast moving as anything he's ever made.
And by proxy, maybe anyone's ever made.
Did it make you sick, Chris?
I was like, if this whole movie is like this, this is going to be intense. Like, I'm going to barf.
I feel like you don't love this kind of filmmaking, Amanda. Like, I feel like you admire like a great set piece, but this is a different kind of thing.
Two key things here. Number one, Florence. Michael Bay and I both appreciate a fine European city. It's not a capital. I know my capitals. Number two, filmed outside. Thank you so much. Daylight.
Yeah.
You love to see it. There are like bright colored cars.
He's driving a lime green sports car.
Yeah.
Dave Franco's character. And he drives through what seems like
every
17
museum.
Plazas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Does Florence have that many plazas? That many?
Yeah, it's Italy.
Okay.
It's like basically
so
what they
accurate?
Do. They have plazas and they have that really big church, the Duomo. Okay. I really enjoyed it when he's like, I'm on the Duomo. We're like, yeah, we know. And then they have museums, which is the end of this car chase. Or it's not really the end. It keeps going. But like maybe the climax of the second act.
Of the car chase.
Of the car chase of the first 17 minutes of this film is them going through the Uffizi, which is like the famous museum in Florence where like the David is. And it's the soundtrack switches from some like anonymous Lumineers nonsense to like dubstep Carmina Burana.
Yeah.
I was jacked. This is great.
Yeah, the music in the movie is notable. It is either dubstep remixes of opera or circa 2002 ripcord guitar music.
Yeah.
Which neither of which is contemporary at all.
Can I also just mention a quick note, which is that we have no idea what's going on in the first 17 minutes of this movie. Like, it's unclear as to why they're running, who they're running from. And that's not because he's playing, like, hide the pinata with it. It's like he's actually just like, fuck it. I'm not telling you why we're in a car chase.
It's incredibly confounding. He keeps putting title cards on the screen, numbers on the screen. We learn that the characters are identified by their numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But also, the time shifting is very strange. It's almost Lindelof-esque, the way that he's bouncing back
he's
into
like
the past.
4 years ago, 6 months ago, 17 minutes ago.
And every
the present.
26 minutes or so, Ryan Reynolds comes up over some voiceover and says, what would happen if you were a ghost?
I know. Like,
here's what I did.
Watch 1:30 for 30, bro. What if I told you?
But
he wouldn't pay taxes.
There's a kind of repetition in the movie that for some filmmakers would be a signature. It would be a stylistic choice to beat you over the head with something. You know, in Hitchcock films, you see these patterns and you can identify them all throughout his movies. And you say like, oh, there's so much intentionality going on here. I genuinely just think that they were confused when they were making this movie.
Yeah.
And they keep saying the same thing over and over again because there's a feeling like, don't look down at your phone. Like, stay with us.
Yeah.
Make sure you're still in this movie with us. Which is a kind of a new form of movie making, like that adrenalized.
There are very few master shots where you're like, oh, the three people have walked into a room and now I understand where they are in space. It's like, I'm like, what? I don't even know what country we're in most of the time, to say nothing of like how a guy gets from the top of a skyscraper to the ground floor without any explanation.
Right.
It's like, it's almost like completely uninterested in most conventional visual storytelling gimmicks.
I do feel like we've noticed with the Netflix movies, and not even these big budget Netflix movies, but like the rom-coms are at a much faster pace and they really are changing what's on the screen every 5 seconds, because I do think they know that your eye will wander unless you're like really locked in. But this feels like the ultimate version of, we're just going to make you stare at the screen because something totally bizarre and unexpected is going to happen. Honestly, like, I know I say every 5 seconds is kind of like a figure of speech, but literally every 5 to 10 seconds.
And it all ramps up to every time they move to a new city, there's a new major set piece. And so there's a new major moment where, whether it's one guy running down, is it the Uffizi? Is that
the Duomo?
He runs down the Duomo, yeah.
Okay, running down the Duomo, that is one. And then there is another one later where they're in a hotel in Japan. Is it in Tokyo?
Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And there's a major moment there. So you have to stay on board. And then there's one later in a country called Turkestan on a yacht. And you got to stick around there for
this
that.
It's probably
moment.
Like the top five Turkestan movie.
You think so? What else is on the list? No? It's promising payoff in fast relief. You know, there's always this expectation that you can't turn away, which I feel like a lot of commercials work this way. I feel like a lot of editing in when you're watching live sports works this way. You know, the inability to let you break your concentration from the sporting event. Movies are not this way.
Mm-hmm.
But this does feel like a functional choice given that it's Netflix.
Well, I think Amanda's point about it being in the daylight and using a lot of like real cities that people recognize, or what differentiates this from something like, say, like another really good action movie like John Wick,
mm-hmm.
where I really love the John Wick movies. The John Wick movies make a lot more sense than Six Underground, but Six Underground kind of shits on the John Wick movies because, like, you're just like, this seems like it's happening in Hong Kong. This seems like it's happening in Florence. This seems like shit is exploding in a major metropolitan European city.
And the sort of gung-fu style that Stahelski and Leach kind of revolutionized with John Wick, which is influenced by those John Woo movies that you're talking about.
And The Raid and stuff like that.
Yes,
yeah.
Is very balletic and very choreographed and very specific. And it's fast, but it's all purposeful. This is a different kind of movie making. Like, it's way more frenetic, and like the shots actually don't match. You know, we were talking after we saw the movie, that opening chase scene where, you know, this lime green sports car is racing and it's sort of sliding against other cars and getting scraped. And then the next cut, there are no scrapes on the car because there's just too many shots. There's too much going on. There's too much noise. There's no way to make the movie cut together to make a logical sense. So if you watch movies and you're like, this has to be perfect, there can be no mistakes. And you, Chris, you pointed out in one of the Transformers movies, notoriously, there's a scene where one of the female characters is running. And in one shot, she's running and she's wearing high heels. Mm-hmm. And in the next shot, she has no shoes on. And then in the next shot, she has her high heels on again. Those mistakes happen in these movies and you have to accept them. Yeah. If you don't accept them as part of the insanity of the process, then you're going to have a harder time with the movie.
But they matter less in this because there's so much going on that it kind of washes over you.
Oh,
I kind of tuned out in one of the set pieces. It was late. I was a little hungry and I was like trying to think about it. And then I tuned back in and I was like, okay, so people are fighting again and you don't actually, because there's a lack of coherence in a lot of different ways, you just kind of are on board with it and you can, which I think will work well for Netflix because people will like look and be engaged when they're looking at it. And if you miss something, it's okay. Also, I mean, just think of the number of screen grabs of all the mistakes that will instantly be memed that people will have a great time with.
Oh, it's a great point. I hadn't thought of that, but we'll be able to instantaneously able to capture that.
It's like Easter eggs.
We could also do we can make juxtaposed memes where we're doing like the Scarlett Johansson Adam Driver fight, but then it's actually like a cutaway to Melanie Laurent, and then Adam Driver punches the wall.
I can't wait for the Melanie Laurent.
We're getting to Melanie. Okay. A couple of more things that make this a unique Michael Bay experience. This movie is very gross.
Yeah, I didn't like this part of it.
Michael Bay movies are amazingly violent. They are fascistically violent and kind of insane and immoral. But this movie, there's more blood splatter. There's more viscera than in any of his movies. I can't totally figure out why.
It wasn't nauseating. It felt more like Sam Raimi to me. It felt like pop art, like gore, rather than like extreme headshot violence. Although early in the movie, there is a lot of like first-person shooter stuff, which clearly he just like abandoned midway through the movie. But like in the beginning, I was like, oh man, is this going to be like
his video game movie?
Some weird fucking video game thing that's supposed to, because, and it was really strange because we walked out of the movie theater and for some reason there was a video game live event happening in the lobby of the movie theater. And I was just like, holy crap, like there's just a dude drinking a Big Gulp playing like a first person shooter. And I was like, you should have been in that movie, man. You would have loved it. But yeah, he abandons that kind of perspective. I thought that a lot of the stuff in Italy and throughout the movie was just like, how can I like push this to the maximal level? There's so much CGI in this movie too.
There is. There's one scene in particular where building materials fall from a building during a chase sequence. That is the most, I thought it was one of the most genius ideas for an action sequence, but was so held back by the fact that it was so CGI.
Yeah, there's no way you could do that without multiple people dying. It was steel beams falling from like a 70-floor building and landing on cop cars.
There's no way to actually make that movie. You know, the one point I wanted to make about him before we go any further is he's never going to get credit for this because people are like, this guy's a gross idiot and they don't want to give him credit. But he was ahead of not just the comic book franchise revolution, but also a very particular kind of action movie making that much more quote-unquote respectable filmmakers like Christopher Nolan adopted and then stripped down. And the famous sequence where the truck flips over in The Dark Knight is a riff on a Bay convention. Mm-hmm. And when you see them sparingly in these sort of more prestigious executions of these movies, they feel more special.
Mm-hmm.
And Bay's execution is like the opposite of that. He's like, I don't need one flipping truck. I need 75 flipping trucks in the next 5 minutes. And he literally gives it to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are, in the chase sequence, how many cars flip over in the first 17 minutes of the movie? It's got to be north of 20.
Yeah, and when that happens, you're like, man, like one of the things that I found myself really like wondering throughout the film is like, well, I was just like, it's kind of like putting Flight of the Valkyries in the middle of the movie. Like, how are you going to top that? There's no way you can top that. And then I was like, oh, yeah, you're just going to add F-16s. You know, like, you're just going to add fighter jets and magnets and all this other shit. And it just, like, completely keeps upping itself.
I want to talk a little bit more about the cast.
Okay.
I'm a fan of Ryan Reynolds. I feel slightly ashamed to say out loud that I'm a fan of Ryan Reynolds. It's not cool like Ryan Reynolds. He is a very smarmy, highly successful agent of franchise Hollywood. And I think that's, there's a lot held against him in that respect. He's also a very handsome guy, married to a very beautiful actress. They seem to have a quote-unquote perfect life. I find him amusing. Mm-hmm. I think this is like the best possible execution for his amusingness. It occurred to me when I was watching it exactly what his persona is, which it, for whatever reason I never thought of before, but it is so clearly guy who looks like Robert Redford with Chevy Chase's personality. And that seems almost unfair that somebody who got to look like that got to just steal that persona. I would look at Joel McHale and be like, oh, Joel McHale is trying to do like What If Chevy Chase but hot. Mm-hmm. But this is actually on a whole other level. And this character, which should be so self-serious and absurd, this billionaire who's a genius inventor, who's got all this money and all this emotional weight behind his do-gooding, mm-hmm. probably shouldn't be like Detective Pikachu, but he is, he's basically just doing Detective Pikachu yeah. in the movie, and I enjoyed it. Do you guys care about Ryan Reynolds at all?
I don't think I'm offended by him. I mean, I just am not going to go on the Deadpool thing, but that's more a genre of pop culture and fandom that I'm not interested in. Ryan Reynolds can do what he wants. I think it's a little unfair to Robert Redford. We don't have to we don't have to get into this hot actor wars right now, but let me just go ahead and say that there's a difference aesthetically between Robert Redford and Ryan Reynolds. On this podcast.
Harrison Ford?
I guess so, but
because he's trying to do the Indiana Jones thing, right? Like where it's like I'm laughing
The thing about Ryan Reynolds, which is in keeping with everything you just described of him, he looks a little Ken doll. He is mm-hmm. very plasticky is unfair, but just generically handsome in a sort of unmemorable way. And so that fits, and you can plug him into any franchise and have him like wisecrack, and he looks great in a suit, and he looks great in the suits in this, and he looks great in, he was wearing some Bond khakis, and that mm-hmm. was nice for him as well. So it's not, Ryan Reynolds, very handsome.
Chris, you're the best.
Yeah, I just was mad about the Robert Redford thing. I think he's good in this movie. I laughed at some of the things. He is in a different movie than the team that he has assembled.
For sure.
Who are in a different movie than the villains that they are fighting. Who are in a different movie than everything that's happening around
them. He might even be in a different
them.
Movie than the Ryan Reynolds who does the voiceover throughout the movie.
Yes, that's yeah. true. Yeah. So there's that. I mean, we definitely just skipped over the part how this movie makes absolutely no sense, like at all, even for a Michael Bay movie.
Well, I'll just say the reason that...
Can I just say one more thing about Ryan Reynolds?
Yeah, of course.
Just that I think if the last 10 to 12 years have taught us anything, it's that it's easier to teach funny people to do action than it is to teach action people to do funny. So Downey Jr., Chris Pratt, Ryan Reynolds, all funny guys in their own way. And it's just like, just put them on keto, you know?
Yeah, and I think that
is it keto or keto?
I actually don't know.
Bobby, can you weigh in on this?
I believe it's keto.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks, Bobby.
glad to be of assistance.
The only person who would have ever possibly attempted keto that I know is Bobby. This movie was written by Paul Wernick and Rhett Reese, and you mentioned Deadpool. They obviously are the scribes behind Deadpool. And my impression of the movie is it doesn't matter if the movie makes sense.
Yeah.
And all it matters is that what Chris is saying, that a funny guy gets to do an action movie. And, you know, it's not that the concept is incoherent. It's just libertarian, as you say, Chris. But I feel like the whole point of those guys working on this movie is so that they could be on set with Ryan Reynolds and just feed him jokes.
Yeah.
And he's good at delivering their jokes. Now, you may not like Deadpool, but he's just doing.
Yeah.
If
now,
Deadpool was Bruce Wayne, you know, that's kind of what the bit is. And I don't know. I enjoyed it. I'm not above it. That's all I can
We're
really
done?
Say.
We're not talking about it anymore?
Well, what else should we say about Ryan Reynolds?
Oh.
He's like arguably the most important actor in Hollywood.
Sure.
I mean, he like transcends a lot of the stuff that we say you can't do anymore.
Important is a strong word. Successful, possibly.
a lot of movies that wouldn't have worked without him hinge on him. You know, like the Deadpool thing should not work, and it does consistently.
He's also
work.
A really interesting example of a guy who's clearly betting on himself. You know, like there's some ways of doing movie stardom and being an actor where you're just like, I'm just going to work with the best people. I'm just always going to try and work with like these really smart directors and really savvily put myself in a position to be recognized by my peers and the press and everything. And he obviously is just like, I think that I'm what sells these movies. I don't think that Tim Miller needs to make the second Deadpool movie. I don't think that like I will be cowed by Michael Bay's style. Like I will get my personality across. I don't necessarily, I wonder whether or not he was like, I should do a VO for Six Underground because otherwise there's not enough me. Like, I'm not saying he did do that, but there's so much Ryan Reynolds because of this voiceover. Like Sean mentioned, every 20 minutes he checks in and he has like a little 3-page monologue that he does.
Yeah, I should say too, like this is a fairly recent turn of events. Like Ryan Reynolds actually was sort of notorious for being a huge failure, for being a Ken Doll-esque funny guy who couldn't make one movie that anyone liked. And it took Deadpool to change that. Now, he made a couple of small movies that I really like. I love Mississippi Grind. I think that's one of the all-time great gambling movies. And I think if he wanted to do what you're saying, if he wanted to, like, Jake Gyllenhaal it and say, like, actually, I was in Prince of Persia. That was a bad idea.
Yeah.
What I should do is work with auteurs, find great scripts, only pursue that kind of work. He would have had an interesting career and not a lot of money. Instead, he was like, no.
He's doing the Downey.
He's doing like, the Downey.
Yeah.
It's a much more modern version of movie star pursuit. Deadpool and Detective Pikachu and Hobbs and Shaw earlier this summer and Six Underground these are very purposeful choices that are quote unquote working. Now, whether or not this movie works is probably up for a different kind of definition.
He's probably the single most seen actor.
Yes.
In 2019.
These are branding activities.
Even including all the MCU guys, which is quite something.
Yeah.
And soon he will be in the MCU because Fox was purchased by Disney. So that's, you know, how long before we catch him in an Avengers movie? It feels inevitable. Let's talk more about the rest of the cast. Melanie Laurent.
Wow.
I'm like, I don't Paul Bettany in Da Vinci Code, just like Opus Deiing myself in front of Melanie Laurent. In this movie.
What's she doing in this movie, you think? What was her thinking when she was like, I need to take this role? Was it like, I need to get a second house in the French Riviera?
I think there is probably some financial incentive. And I think there's also just like, I'm a French person. And so,
auteur theory, baby.
Yeah, auteur theory. And also, I don't care. Like these, you know, I would like to be in a silly American thing. So I think that this is fun for her.
And if you're going to do it, do this.
Yeah.
If you're going to be in a candy colored, spray painted graffiti of immorality and debased military industrial complex propaganda, do fucking this one. You know,
I liked what she did with it. I enjoyed her the whole time.
You're underselling this.
Well, I want people to watch the film.
Okay.
I want them to watch her in white lingerie on a bed.
You're making it sound like she's like ScarJo in like
the spoiler-free version of this podcast. Because I mean, I don't know, fam.
She's fantastic. Her character makes no sense, and much like every other figure in the movie, to search for like meaning, because there's no Melanie Laurent career arc to examine. Like there is with Ryan Reynolds. It's like she's a great actor. Every 5 years, she's like gets to be in Inglourious Bastards or Beginners or something where you're like, I just like her. I just want to be around her. This is the weirdest possible use for her, but there's no downside. There's just no downside.
She looks great. She's wearing a tux.
Yep.
She just is like in the middle of a desert and by a sports car for some reason. I do feel like
just
if
dealing out headshots to dudes.
If you're going to be, if you want to be an actor, like if that is an aspiration for you, I feel like deep down somewhere inside of you, you want to be leaning against a sports car like filmed by Michael Bay.
Yeah.
You want that level of objectification and also glorification.
Decontextualized from any narrative. It's just like, oh, I get to have this piece of like ephemera with me for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
My children will see once mom stood in the middle of a desert while Lamborghinis like drove up to her.
What about Dave Franco? Paycheck?
I guess so. I feel like he's having everything or 2 years.
I think he and Ryan Reynolds are a bit too much like two guys looking in a mirror.
They don't have a lot of chemistry.
I didn't think
movie.
So either.
The timing was not on.
Yeah, they're too the same.
They're driving 75 miles per hour through.
But they're not.
Though. Oh, yeah.
That's a good point. They're sitting on a truck somewhere.
They were trying to be in the realism of the moment.
Right.
Yeah.
So he was okay. The one who really struck me is Peyman Mahdi. For those of you who are not familiar with Peyman Mahdi, he is the star of many of Asghar Farhadi's films, the Iranian filmmaker. He also appeared in 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi.
He did.
He's a wonderful actor. You know, he's from Tehran. He's been in some American productions, but like he's best known for these very sophisticated, quiet stories of families being torn apart that Farhadi makes. And halfway through this movie, he plays the brother of an evil dictator in this movie. I turned to Zach, your husband, Amanda, and I was like, yo, Zach, that's the dude from A Separation. And it's just an amazing thing. Again, much like Melanie, much like Dave, certainly like Ryan Reynolds, I suspect the paycheck was nice. Yeah. He does perfectly fine work. I would say the arc of his character is a bit confusing.
Yes.
He is jet-streamed into righteous leadership rather quickly.
Yeah.
How do I talk about that without spoiling it much more?
He's vying for the presidency of Turkestan with his evil brother. And the Six Underground have chosen him.
Did you think those guys were credible brothers?
Those two, like visually?
Yeah.
No. I didn't think that anything about Turkestan was well thought out.
Yeah. That's well said.
It's not ideal.
Including
also,
the name.
Yeah, I mean, it felt very throwbacky in
Hard-G
that respect.
Or Softy? It was changing throughout the movie. That was one thing. They couldn't even get the
Turkestan or Turkestan?
Yeah.
I think Turkestan.
It definitely, they were saying Turkestan at some point in the movie. They could have also said Turkestan.
It's tough. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about what Netflix is doing right now.
Mm-hmm. What a run for those guys.
That's literally what he wrote down in the document. Just
did
so
he really?
You know. Yes, he wrote Netflix's run. This is the title of this section.
When do you want to talk about Skydance, though?
We'll get there.
Skydance is back.
Thanksgiving, The Irishman.
Uh-huh.
December 6th, Marriage Story. December 13th, Six Underground. The Two Popes, December 20th. Never in the history of major motion pictures has one studio released in four consecutive weekends films of this magnitude. Never. It's unprecedented. It seems dumb because you can go home and put it on your TV and
Eat
it doesn't
shit,
feel like
Jack
a big
Warner.
Deal. But truly, RKO can fuck right off. Columbia, nothing.
Louis Mayer,
peace out.
Rolling in his grave and then hitting next episode, please.
Yes, truly weak. I want to read a piece of information I found on Wikipedia that is almost certainly dubious.
Is this the Turkestan?
It's not
entry?
About Turkestan. The film's production reportedly cost $150 million, the second most expensive film in the Netflix platform since.
Bright.
That's exactly right. Will Smith's Bright.
That is a lie that this movie cost $150 million.
How much do you think it cost?
I honestly think it cost $300 million. I think it cost twice as much. Unless all of it is
VFX.
I would
absolutely believe that.
Every shot is on location, even if the country is made up. Every shot is from a helicopter. The camera work is... It feels like there are 40 cameras on every
and
sequence.
Even if you stipulate that a lot of it is VFX, and they can do incredible things with computers, I hear. But like just the amount of chopper shots, like helicopter shots he does, you do understand that if he misses it the first time around, they have to turn a helicopter around. It takes a long time. And I have no idea what the production, like, based on some of the socio-political, geopolitical storylines that they're touching on, it seems like this movie has been in the works for quite a while. But, like, the amount of time it must have taken just to shoot the most basic sequences where there's just, like, fucking jet flies over, but there's a helicopter going over the jet, and then there's, like, nine dolly shots of a guy walking into an abandoned plane. And it's like, that would take, that's, like, all of Marriage Story. All the money that you would have used to make Marriage stories in like one shot of this movie.
I say fine. What else are you going to spend it on Netflix? Spend it on this. This is a monument to excess. And in many ways, what Netflix has been doing as a corporation has been a monument to excess, to technocracy. And I'm cool with it.
I think all that is true, that Netflix does a lot. And this movie also does a lot. I do wonder what it's like watching it at home versus watching it where we were. Uh-huh. We watched it together in a theater that was so loud. It was so loud. But that is part of the point.
I also feel like not unlike the conversation around Irishman, which I was not a good Catholic in my watching. I watched it in two nights. But if you stop watching this I don't know if it will make any sense. Like, part of it is you have to kind of just do it for 2 hours and then not think about it too much.
Yeah.
But if you pick it up again after 45 minutes, you're going to be like, wait, what? Why are we in Afghanistan?
I agree with this. The idea that, is it so incoherent that if you're watching at home, you're just like, I don't really understand what's going on? Because visually, it's like a piece of art, right? It's like fine art. You're just kind of like, it's like going to a exhibit at MoMA and you're just like, I can't believe this is going on. But at home, you need something to keep you going from scene to scene.
Yeah.
And I do wonder whether, like, if the explosions kind of become numbing at a point and you're just like, I do not understand why they're doing this, whether that's an ideal viewing experience for something.
We should do like the viewing guide like they did for Irishman.
Yeah.
Like after 41 minutes, you can stop.
I just, it's not ideal for the Netflix experience. My advice to you is if you have a big sound bar to make sure it's connected to your television, put it on the biggest television you have. Treat it like you would treat Apocalypse Now. Not because Apocalypse Now is the same piece of art as Six Underground. Six Underground has a long way to go before it can get
both
to the Apocalypse
Both movies are about
now.
Some guys.
They're about dudes on a mission.
Yeah.
They're both about dudes on a mission and Melanie Laurent. But, and also, you know, the extended cut of Apocalypse Now is what happens when the French travel to Asia and try and make bad choices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they have something else in common.
Okay.
But you just gotta, you can't watch it on your phone, can't watch it on your iPad, you can't watch it on your laptop. I'm not saying that to scold people who watch things that way. I think in general, people can watch whatever they want, whenever they want. I don't really care. But it doesn't, if you want to invest in this movie, it doesn't make sense to try to do it on an iPad.
Can I just say that you have been a lot more stringent about how people can watch Six Underground than you are about The Irishman?
That's
you
true.
Just are. That's you. And we're proud of you and are proud to share this airspace with
you're
you.
The,
but
the
vulgar podcaster. I just want to note that that is a true thing that happened.
I just really, any movie experience where I want to turn to my friends and be like, can you believe this shit?
Yeah,
that's a good that's movie true. To me. It doesn't make it a useful piece of art, but it's a good movie. I just want to be tantalized. You know, there's nothing wrong with that.
What can... How in the world are they going to measure success for this?
I
like, even if there are like 80 million people watch this in its first week, like there, it doesn't seem like the kind of movie that actually will get them new subscribers. Or am I wrong about that?
It's a good question. I've given this some thought. I do think it does one thing, which is that Netflix's brand is not very male, and it has become more male with movies like The Irishman. And you know, there are some TV shows that I think fit the bill there, but for the most part, it's kind of gender neutral, I would say. I wouldn't say it's like overtly feminine in any way. It's not like Lifetime where they're targeting an audience, but the kind of content that they have is friendly for families. It's friendly for people increasingly who like episodic television and sort of reality / competition television. And it's very sort of like documentary immersive friendly, where people just want to like put something on and learn stuff for 6 hours. It doesn't have that muscular, masculine ideal that Bay pursues. And that's not really like a very in vogue thing at all, but it is still a thing that drives a lot of business and entertainment. You know, we've kind of shifted to like MCU and nerd culture taking over this sort of thing. But there is still an appetite, I think, for movies like this. And frankly, even more so if people don't have to go to the movie theater for it. I think they're actually excited about the idea of getting a kind of a kick-ass action movie at home. Especially if they're rich guys who've got 70-inch screens in their house.
I think all of that is true. The counter argument is that I think outside of this podcast, Six Underground will probably not be reviewed super well.
No.
And I just am curious. I don't want to go out on a limb.
Yeah.
But I don't think everyone has as
this movie's incoherent.
Elastic a mind as
it's Sean incoherent.
Does.
It's morally bankrupt.
We didn't even really talk about that because this is apparently we turned this into a spoiler-free podcast like 30 minutes into it. Sorry, guys. But we are aware of that plot line and we're available to discuss it at a later time. Anyway, if this movie isn't reviewed well and the poster, as we were all noting before the screening started, is like a joke. It's like a child with Microsoft Paint to it. and this movie just doesn't seem at all serious. Like, is it going to be the kind of thing that people are like, oh, yeah,
it looks like
I'll
a Melissa McCarthy movie on the poster.
It does.
So what is a win then? What do you guys think is considered success?
I don't know. If 80 million people watch this on Netflix and they sign up however many new subscribers is the thing that's a win for them. But do they release that information?
I don't even think there's a lot of awareness of this movie.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm doing more advocacy than most movies that we talk about on this show.
There's next to none. I mean, I think that literally there is like a cohort at our company of people who are like, I can't wait, bring me the six. And then I don't think anyone knows this is happening.
But I don't know if that matters because they're just going to slot it into the homepage on Netflix and things will just start exploding as soon as you open the Netflix app for a large number of people. And, you know, most people aren't like us with their little like nerdy release calendars. They just open up the thing and are like, what can I watch?
And they're all going to be home for Christmas and they're all going to be bored and they're all going to be like, what should I watch? Or they can download it and watch it on their flights home.
Maybe that's why. Shout out to my husband who we walked out of this movie and he's like, there weren't as many boobs as I would have thought for Michael Bay without any restrictions. But maybe it's because they want people to watch it with their families. And as soon as you see the, I don't know, just
it's
my thought.
It's perfectly okay to put a flashback bang grenade in someone's mouth and blow their head off.
Sean,
but one breast.
Yes. Welcome to America in 2019.
Also, there
okay?
are so many butt shots. Like, yeah, there are so many shots that open with, like, a woman walking across the screen, like, and it's just, like, she's wearing, like,
clothes,
yeah.
And it's like a bad airline.
Yeah, it leaves a lot to the imagination.
I mean,
true.
I'm just saying.
From boom to boobs, we covered it all here, guys. This has been a conversation about Six Underground. Chris, thanks for your generosity.
Thanks for having me, guys.
You showed us what's at the heart of the fascist male in this country. Chris Ryan is gone, but Amanda and I are still here. Amanda, we're going to talk quickly about the SAG Awards. The nominations came out this week. Some interesting revelations here. What did you make of how the Screen Actors Guild decided to put this awards race in a new direction?
It's their right. And I mostly was disappointed in myself because there were a couple things that happened, especially in the outstanding performance by a cast in a motion picture, which is the SAG Awards version of Best Picture. It's the Ensemble Award. That I had even predicted, and I let the Golden Globes knock me off the strength of my convictions. And then I should have stuck with them. And I'm speaking specifically about Bombshell, which was nominated for the ensemble performance. And Charlize Theron was nominated for Best Actress, which she is a lock. Margot Robbie was nominated for Best Supporting Actress, which we have also been predicting. And Nicole Kidman was also nominated for Supporting Actress. And I had this on my original Best Picture predictions because I was like, actors will love this movie. And then Golden Globes didn't love it. And I was like, oh, but of course actors love this movie. And of course this is still in the race. And I think that is an important thing to remember is that a large number of actors vote for the Academy Awards.
It's by far the biggest body out of all the various guilds. And you're completely right. I didn't see it coming either, but it makes total sense. You've got a lot of really winning people. In Charlize and Nicole Kidman, you've got two people who are frequently honored. Who are really, there's a ton of respect for both of them. And in Margot Robbie, you have somebody who's basically just picking up the mantle that Nicole Kidman started like 25 years ago. She's kind of having her career in a very similar fashion. She's got a lot of control of the projects that she picks. She's really talented. She's beautiful. And she's trying to make a statement about the kind of actor that she wants to be with every part that she picks. And it's paying off. The Nicole Kidman nomination in the supporting category is like clear indication to me that like there's way more support for the movie than I originally thought. Supporting actress, not the strongest category here in the first place, something we talked about during our Golden Globes conversation. So that might also be a factor. But it's a big boost for Bombshell. Also a big boost for Jojo Rabbit.
Yeah. I mean, this is the other thing where we were like, oh, I guess Jojo Rabbit's fading and we should have known better.
Same deal. I mean, why do you think that actors like Jojo Rabbit so much?
Because isn't it daring what you can do when you can play anybody? I mean, this is like legit Scarlett Johansson, you know, I should be able to play a tree stuff, like taken to its extreme, that Taika Waititi should be able to play Hitler, which actors clearly believe. But they believe it so much that they nominated Scarlett Johansson in the Best Supporting category for Jojo Rabbit, along with Scarlett Johansson in the Best Actress category for Marriage Story.
Very rare. I don't expect that to be the case at the Oscars. I think she'll only get the Marriage Story nomination, but we'll have to keep an eye on it. I do think that the one thing that we agreed on with Jojo Rabbit that we liked is the kids in the movie are very good, and they're very funny and charming, and I don't hate Jojo Rabbit. It just didn't really work on me. Like, I felt like it wasn't very funny. and it also wasn't very moving. And if you kind of have to be one or the other for a movie of this kind, you know, I appreciate that they were trying to take a chance on something, but it just never clicked.
I would agree with that. And I think part of my resistance to it, at least, was like I was not ready for 4 months of Jojo Rabbit discourse. And we've avoided a couple of those at this point. The most they can give us now is 2 months of Jojo Rabbit discourse. And I don't even know if we're going to get that because it still feels like a happy to be here situation.
I agree. It feels like it's running in like sixth or seventh place, which if you had asked me 2 months ago, I would have said it wasn't going to be in the top three. You know, I think what remains there in terms of winners is some of the big guys that we already know. We know that The Irishman is going to do very well at the Oscars. We know that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is going to do very well at the Oscars. They were both nominated for Ensemble. One movie that we assume is going to do well, but this is probably official confirmation, is Parasite.
Yes.
Which it's highly unusual for a foreign language film to get the Ensemble cast nomination. Highly unusual. I think Life is Beautiful was the last time.
Yes.
21 years ago.
And I believe this is only the second time in the SAG Awards history.
So that's like...
That's great news.
If you're worried about it hitting Best Picture, like it's in. It's in. It's going
don't
to happen.
Don't say that. Don't say that.
I feel confident.
Just don't jinx it. Okay. I mean, let's say it, but don't jinx it. That's what I meant.
It would be quite an upset.
I don't know. I was here just being like, goodbye, Bombshell. Goodbye, Jojo Rabbit, like 2 days ago. And now I have to be like, I was wrong.
But those movies still feel like they're fortunate to be in the race, whereas Parasite is the movie that a lot of film Twitter has their heart in. And a lot of regular Hollywood seems to have their heart in, which is pretty cool. I mean, I don't know. There's no precedent for this.
Everything that you're saying is true, and I just refuse to get my hopes up. I've had them crushed before.
A few of the birds in my life, a few of the Academy birds are like, watch out. It's going to win. Watch out.
That'd be great.
I have no idea how credible that is, but it's happening. Christian Bale.
Here he is.
He was there for the Globes, and he's here for the SAG Awards. Actors fucking love Christian Bale.
They really do.
They're like, this guy is a unicorn. He can do anything. And even though he's basically playing an elevated race car driving version of himself, people love that too.
Yeah. We should also just note that Taron Egerton, your hard work paid off, buddy.
It did.
And you glad hand.
Yes.
And here you are.
How many times do you think Taron Egerton has applied Purell to his hands after shaking people's hands this year?
I don't know that Brits are as germ conscious as we are, but I hope a lot.
Oh.
You know.
I'm such an ugly American. Sake. Jesus.
I'm just saying.
Lupita Nyong'o.
This is great.
She bounced back from getting snubbed by the Globes. That's nice. Cynthia Erivo.
Big week for Cynthia Erivo.
Yeah. Feels like that's kind of hardening. That race, she might have a space there. Be interesting to see what happens with Best Actress. I still think that's a slightly confusing category to me. Losers. There's a tough one here for you.
Yeah, it's outlook not good for Little Women.
Why do you think this is? This is a true ensemble piece.
I have some unkind thoughts and some thoughts that I'll share, which I think it's coming out on Christmas Day, and people haven't seen it in the same way that they've seen a lot of these other movies. And I think also there's resistance to a period drama adaptation that's been made before. I think there are a lot of people who are just like, why do I need to see this? And that's a bummer, but it just kind of is what it is. And those two together maybe just mean that it doesn't have the reach.
I'm not counting it out yet.
Yeah.
The Oscar race is longer than this race. We don't even have Oscar shortlists yet. You know, we don't even know what the voting is going to be like. And in fact, the way that things happen at the Globes will have a significant impact on people, how people vote. And I think the movie is probably going to be a hit, which will be helpful, even though the season has been shortened this year and there's not as much time to kind of stew on these things.
It is notable, like Saoirse didn't even get nominated in the Best Actress category.
Yeah, that's really weird.
Yeah.
Also a bit surprising is the absence of the two popes here. No nominations for Jonathan Pryce or Anthony Hopkins. And that's not a good sign. The two popes, obviously, shot out of a cannon at Telluride. People were like, this is the sleeper surprise that, you know, we thought it was going to be Jojo Rabbit. You thought it was going to be A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood or Joker. It's actually the two popes. This is the feel-good movie that's going to take over. And it really hasn't happened. It got a little bit of a bounce from the Golden Globes, but